Psalm 62. Let us hear God's word. To the chief musician, to Jeduthun, a psalm of David. Truly my soul waiteth upon God. From Him cometh my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. How long will ye imagine mischief against a man? Ye shall be slain, all of you. As a bowing wall shall ye be, and as a tottering fence. They only consult to cast him down from his excellency. They delight in lies. They bless with their mouth, but they curse inwardly. Selah. My soul, wait thou only upon God, for my expectation is from Him. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be moved. In God is my salvation and my glory. The rock of my strength and my refuge is in God. Trust in Him at all times, ye people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us. Selah. Surely men of low degree are vanity, and men of high degree are a lie. To be laid in the balance, they are altogether lighter than vanity. Trust not in oppression, and become not vain in robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart upon them. God hath spoken once. Twice have I heard this, that power belongeth unto God. Also unto thee, O Lord, belongeth mercy, for thou renderest to every man according to His work. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. It's Lord's Day morning. We come again to our monthly prayer meeting and our survey of the Psalms. And this month we come to Psalm 62. This psalm is a prayer. It is a prayer of affliction. And it's a prayer of affliction that focuses uniquely on trust and confidence of the psalmist. I've entitled the psalm Waiting on God, or Wait on God. Spurgeon called this psalm the only psalm, because the word the Hebrew word that's translated only in this psalm is used six different times. It's not always translated only. The very first word of the psalm is the same word that's translated truly. It could be translated verily or only. You also could say that this psalm is about psalmist not being moved. He resolved both in verse 2 and in 6 to not be moved. He's prepared to possess his soul in patience, and he's resolved to do so. We have no context given to this psalm. And obviously when contexts are given, it's intentional. And obviously when they're not given, it is intentional as well. In verse 8a, where God tells us through David to trust in Him at all times. And so this psalm is always appropriate. Whatever the context we find ourselves in, this psalm of trust and confidence in the midst of affliction is always appropriate. Now in the title, we see that it is to the chief musician. David's prepared to give this psalm to the chief musician for safekeeping, for congregational singing. It is to or for Jeduthun, which is Ethan. We have Psalms 39 and 77 are for him, dedicated to him. Psalm 89 is written by him. We're told in 1 Chronicles chapter 16, as well as in chapter 25, verse 1, that he and his sons were singers and players and the doorkeepers of the temple. We're told that this is a psalm of David. And in this psalm, David encourages himself in verses 1 through 7 to wait on God. And then in verses 8 through 12, he encourages the people of God to wait on God. And in one sense, he's not only encouraging himself in verses 1 through 7, we could say he's encouraging us by example in verses 1 through 7. And in verses 8 through 12, he's encouraging us by exhortation. Let's look at verses 1 through 7. David encouraging himself to wait on God. David encouraging us by his example. In verses 1 and 2a, we have his profession of dependence. Truly my soul waiteth upon God, from him cometh my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. As I said, this word truly could be translated only. Only my soul waiteth upon God. Literally, only my soul is silent to God. David's not saying that he doesn't pray to God. What he's saying is he doesn't complain to God in discontent. So he's prepared to wait upon God and not try to take things into his own hands or complain about the speed at which God answers his prayers. Matthew Henry, commenting on this verse, says, "We are in the way both of duty and comfort when our souls wait upon God, when we cheerily refer ourselves and the disposal of all our affairs to God's will and providence." And so it's a duty and a comfort to wait upon God. He says, the psalmist says that it's from him that cometh his salvation. In other words, his eternal deliverance as well as his temporal deliverance will ultimately come from God. He goes on to say, God is my rock, my salvation, my defense. I saw something more something interesting in one of the commentators this week, and that is when he was speaking about David talking about God as his rock, the commentator said that it really is probably referring not to so much just that it's a God is big or that we're on top of him and we're protected by him. He says really the metaphor of God being our refuge or our fortress fulfills that. But the commentator suggested that when David talks about God being his rock, he's probably thinking about the cavernous rocks of the Middle East where he had to hide from Saul. And if you think about events in the Middle East of late and Al-Qaeda members hiding in those rocks, you realize that God protected David. He's his rock. So it probably is referring to his the cavernous rocks of the Middle East. But he's our salvation. He's David's deliverer, and he's his defense, or literally his high fort. So David, professing his dependence, he then pronounces doom upon his enemies in verses 2b through 4. He really resolves to be steadfast in 2a, 2b. I shall not be greatly moved. He's resolved to be steadfast. See, I think Paul could had that same experience. He describes it to the people at Corinth in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, where he says, you know, these things have happened to me, and yet I'm not totally destroyed by them. Just think he says in verse 8, I'm perplexed, but not in despair. Things are messy, but I haven't gone into despair because I know God is in control of all these things. So, David here is possessing his soul in patience, as the Apostle Paul did. But then he looks on his enemies with contempt in verses 3 through 4. He knows, as Paul did, obviously, that all things work together for his good, as Paul says in Romans 8:28 and 29. But remember, in verse 30, we're told that if God be for us, who can be against us? Paul's not saying that nothing is against us, but ultimately there's no power against us that is greater than God's power and strength. And so David here asserts that as he speaks of his enemies. He says they imagine mischief. In other words, they are envious, and that's at the bottom of their malice. They are like a bulging wall, a bowing wall. It's talking about a wall that is attracting moisture and is expanding. It's probably a metaphor, a picture of a proud person. This wall, because of that, is eventually going to topple. And speaking of someone that's proud and bulging with pride, but will eventually topple. He says they delight in lies. They bless and they curse. It reminds me of words of James in James 3:9, where he says, from this mouth come, we bless God with this mouth, and then we curse men. As he speaks about the necessity of taming the tongue and the difficulty of it. So they're given to falsehood. They're given to falsehood in two unique forms: flattery, blessing, and cursing or slandering. And it is interesting in the Proverbs how you see the flatterer and the slanderer are often the same person. But David clearly is saying, those that take the sword shall perish by the sword. Those that set a trap will fall into the trap. And so he takes a pause, a Selah, as he contemplates the doom of his and God's enemies. Then in verses 5 through 7, we have David's encouragement to wait. My soul, wait thou only upon God, for my expectation is from Him, begins this section in verse 5. He's talking to himself. My soul, he's speaking to his inner man, exhorting himself, wait thou only upon God. Don't wait upon God and something else, but wait upon God and Him alone. For my expectation is from Him. He says, the reason I should do this is because my hope or expectation is in Him. I'm trusting in Him to do something in the future. Spurgeon said, hope is the child of faith and prayer. David has faith, he prays, now he has hope. He has an expectation of what God will do ultimately. Then in verse 6, he repeats nearly identically verse 2. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be moved. Here's the word only again. Notice God is David's rock, his salvation, his defense. My. But there's one word missing in verse 6 that's found in verse 2, and that's the word greatly. Greatly is missing. And I think what that probably implies is some growth even in David's faith in this psalm. Matthew Henry said, the more faith acts, the more active it is. See, as faith is exercised, it grows. It becomes more active. And David's exercising his faith in this prayer that is a song or a psalm. And then we see his holy triumph in verse 7. In God is my salvation and my glory. The rock of my strength and my refuge is in God. Just a comment, the word my again. Not just in verse 6, but throughout verse 7. You see, children, David not only knows about God, but he knows God. And there's a world of difference between knowing about someone and actually knowing someone. You see, quite often when someone asks you about someone, do you know John Doe? And you don't, but you know of them. You should say, I know of them. I don't know them. I've not met them, but I know of them. I know about them a little bit. But I'm not intimately acquainted with them. I don't have a relationship with them. What David is saying is, I just don't know about God. I know God. I have a relationship with Him. So we see an experimental relationship, a close, warm friendship that he sustains with God. God is his salvation, glory, rock, strength, refuge, defense. And then David, having encouraged himself in verses 1 through 7, encourages the people of God to wait on God. He first counsels us all to wait on God in verse 8. Trust in Him at all times, ye people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us. Selah. So here he turns the corner. A little different focus. He's been talking about God being his God, his protector. He's talked to himself about waiting upon God. Now he talks to God's people. And it's often the way it is in the Psalms. The Psalms are oftentimes very individualistic to start, and then near the end, they become corporate. The psalmist recognizes that he is part of the people of God. And him being blessed is due to the blessing upon God's people. And vice versa. So his audience is ye people. He says, God is a refuge not for me now, but for us. David exhorts us to confide in God, trust in Him at all times, in prosperity and adversity. But he also calls us to converse with God. Pour out your heart before Him. What a description of prayer. Pouring out our hearts. I think you probably heard that description of prayer before. It's found in this psalm. Spurgeon says it means to turn yourself inside out before God. But most of us aren't that vulnerable, are we? We're certainly not that vulnerable to people, but most of us aren't that vulnerable with God. We really, in practice, believe somehow we can keep things from Him, as though He doesn't know our inner thoughts, our inner griefs. So Spurgeon says, give your grief to God, not to yourself. That's what David's talking about. If you open your heart to Him, you turn yourself inside out, you've given all your griefs to Him. John Calvin commenting says this, listen carefully, it's a relatively long quote, not a quote, longer than the quotes I usually give. Usually, indeed, men show much anxiety and ingenuity in seeking to escape from the troubles which may happen to press upon them. But so long as they shun coming into the presence of God, they only involve themselves in a labyrinth of difficulties. Children, you know what a labyrinth is? Have you ever entered one of those things where there's shrubs and you start walking around, you're trying to find your way out? Or have you ever seen those little puzzles where you enter with your pencil and you try to work yourself around to find the exit somewhere? That's a labyrinth. And Calvin says if we have trouble and we try to find the solution, anything else other than God, we just wrap ourselves in a circle. We're just getting in deeper trouble. But he goes on to say, David is here to be considered as exposing that diseased but deeply rooted principle in our nature, which leads us to hide our griefs and ruminate upon them instead of relieving ourselves at once by pouring out our prayers and complaints before God. He goes on to say, the consequence is that we are distracted more and more with our distress and merge into a state of hopeless despondency. You see, Paul could say, as I mentioned in 2 Corinthians 4:8, I'm perplexed, I've been perplexed, but I wasn't in despair. Because Paul wasn't prepared to just focus upon his grief, but he was prepared to take his grief to God. And when we take our griefs to God, God will deal with them. But if we think ourselves adequate, we just dig ourselves deeper and deeper into despondency and despair, spiritual depression. And so David, having counseled us to wait himself, takes a Selah and encourages us to take a pause. Spurgeon, commenting on this pause, says, sheep may well lie down when such pasture is before them. When they recognize that they are to trust in God, that He is a refuge and will hear their prayers. So David, having encouraged us to rest upon God, confide in Him, and console with Him. He then, in verses 9 and 10, cautions us related to our confidences in anything else. He says, place your confidence in God in verse 8. In verses 9 and 10, he says, don't place your confidence in men or money. Verse 9, surely men of low degree are vanity, and men of high degree are a lie. To be laid in the balance, they are altogether lighter than vanity. He says, you need to know that men won't support you. Men of low degree, men of high degree. Democracy or aristocracy won't solve your problems. They're vain. They're empty. All the men you can pile up, there's still not going to be any help. Even if you go to the men of high degree, aren't they but a lie oftentimes? So don't place your hope in men, also in money in verse 10. Trust not in oppression and become not vain in robbery. Seems to be telling us not to trust in ill-gotten gain in the first part of the verse. But then he goes on to say, if riches increase, set not your heart upon them. Here he seems to be referring to honest gain. Even when riches increase from honest labor, we're not to set our hearts upon them or place our trust in them, but ought to place our trust in the giver of those gifts. And so David, having cautioned us regarding false confidences in verses 9 and 10, then provides two good reasons why we ought to place our confidence or faith in God. He says first in verse 11, God hath spoken once, twice have I heard this. A little bit difficult portion of Scripture to understand exactly what's being said here. Some say it refers to God speaking in His Word and His providence. God is powerful and God is merciful. And that we can see it in His Word explicitly, we can see it implicitly in creation and in providence. Spurgeon comments and says maybe we ought to consider it in this light, that we ought to see that we ought to have the echo of God's voice in our meditations. He has spoken, but we need to remind ourselves of Him speaking as we ruminate upon His Word. And He speaks it again and again. We need to hear God's Word over and over again, don't we? We're slow to listen and to really hear, aren't we? And to hear thoroughly and intently. So whatever this is referring to, once or twice, we need to hear it again and again and again. God is infinite in power. Power belongs to God. But so does mercy. Also unto thee, O Lord, belongeth mercy. Consider the words of David in Psalm 130, verse 7. Let Israel hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is mercy, and with Him is plenteous redemption. We can hope in God because there is mercy and forgiveness with our God. Remember, Paul calls Him the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort in 2 Corinthians 1:3. And David tells us that God is all-powerful and all-merciful, infinitely, eternally, and unchangeably so. For thou renderest to every man according to his work. At first I thought in verse 12b, David was telling us that God's infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in His righteousness or His justice. And that is true, but the word for suggests something other than that. This isn't just another one of God's attributes in David's line. I think what David is saying is he's saying that God is all-powerful and He is merciful, therefore He will, in His mercy, judge His enemies and mine. Thou renderest to every man according to his works. This isn't to promote salvation by good works. It's assuming the good works of those that have been made righteous by a faith given to them by God. It's something akin to the prayer of Solomon when the temple was finished in 1 Kings 8:32. He says there in his prayer to God, hear thou in heaven, and do, and judge thy servants, condemning the wicked to bring his way upon his head, and justifying the righteous to give him according to his righteousness. And so God is merciful and powerful in justice as well as in mercy. In judgment and in salvation, God is and remains powerful and merciful. And so Matthew Henry, commenting on this verse, says, let those therefore that are wronged commit their cause to God and trust to Him to plead it. In other words, if we're done wrong, God will plead our cause and
we can rely in Him and Him alone. In application, in closing, consider again Matthew Henry's words. He says in his commentary, and it's very interesting, in Matthew Henry, in almost every psalm, the comments on almost every psalm, either at the very beginning or the very last words of his comments, he says something related to how we ought to sing the psalm. He certainly understood that the psalms weren't just for reading and preaching, they were also for singing. The beginning of his comments on this psalm, he says, in singing it, we should stir up ourselves to wait upon God. John Brown, in his comments on the psalm, says, while I sing, go thou my soul and do likewise. Be weaned from all dependence on creatures, but cleave to and depend on this all-sufficient Yahweh as answerable to all thy needs, all thy desires, all thy enjoying powers for time and for eternity. Then, oh, how fixed in safety and how filled with the consolation